Is Sutton your reaction to the global financial crisis?
Oh, very much. I had started a book with kind of a sports theme, and I'd done a lot of work on it. It was a book more about college football, and I was really enjoying researching it, and I had a pretty good sense of where it was going and how long it would take. But this was late 2008, 2009, and the world was ending, and bankers seemed to be the cause of the apocalypse, and I was getting angrier and angrier. And I thought, you know, maybe now is the time to write about that anger and from the point of view of that anger and explore that anger. And I set aside the college football book because I thought it would be it was the right moment to write about banks. And I thought a good way of writing about banks, from at least from my point of view, would be to write about somebody who hated them almost as much as I do. And that's Willie Sutton, who once upon a time was the face of American bank robbery. And I was shocked that there hasn't been a book about Willie already, other than the two memoirs he wrote, which cancel each other out because they're both fiction and self-contradictory. I was amazed that there's been no novel about him, no biography. So it just seemed like the way was clear. It seemed like the moment was right. It seemed like it would really fit the tenor of the times, the zeitgeist, to explore a guy who led kind of a 40-year war against banks.
How aware were you of the previous global meltdowns of the 20th century? Because frankly, until reading your book, other than the Great Depression and the early 80s, it was not something I was very much aware of.
Yeah, no, me neither. I mean, I was dimly aware that the history of capitalism is a history of crashes and recoveries, but I didn't know there had been so many similar crises similar to the one that we suffered in 2008 and 2009, bank panics and banks demanding bailouts and banks overleveraged and housing bubbles. And I didn't know that chronic unemployment was such a cyclical problem. I didn't know that, you know, how much the crash of exactly 100 years before, the crash of 1907, was similar, and that banks were teetering until they were bailed out and that they were too big to fail. And I didn't know about the crash of 1893 and the huge recession that followed World War I. And I didn't know about the crashes of the mid-1800s. And I mean, there was a period there where sort of every 15 or 20 years there was another cataclysmic crash. And I was amazed that we have such short memories. And I hoped to kind of reinforce that point in the book, that we all thought 2008, 2009 was so incredibly different. And really it was just... it was just a rerun. It was a repeat, and none of us were around to catch the first airings. And for that matter, 87, which I did live through, but I didn't realize how similar and how interconnected these things all are.
One of the ways that I found that Willie can relate to the common man once he's already robbed the banks and made his millions is through sports. Talks a lot about sports, wishing that he was compared to Jackie Robinson instead of Babe Ruth. He's in a bar in Brooklyn during the shot heard round the world. He goes to Yankee Stadium opening day in 1923. Do you think that still exists nowadays, that escape with sports, or has sports gotten too big?
Well, I do think sports has gotten too big, but I don't think that keeps it from being an escape for all of us. And I think it has, you know, at least as much, probably more cultural importance as it did in Willie's day. I thought that connecting Willie to sports helped me make the point that we find heroes, cultural heroes, in unlikely places. And it's improbable that we make these athletes so iconic, that we make them into such heroes, because they're often so undeserving. But it's no less, you know, odd that we make bank robbers and criminals like Capone or Dillinger into folk heroes. I mean, we have a strange selection process, winnowing process for our cultural heroes. And I was interested in exploring how Willie Sutton came to be called by New York City cops the Babe Ruth of bank robbers. I mean, they had been chasing him. They'd been frustrated by him. They had spent all this time and money trying to find him. And then when they catch him, they sort of pay him a compliment. They call him the Babe Ruth of bank robbers. That hardly casts him in a sinister light for the public. So, yeah, I used sports in the book as a way of reinforcing the idea that I was exploring about how it is that certain people rise to become household names in America and in North America.
Did you grow up hearing about the legend of Willie Sutton at Dickens?
I did. I mean, I heard about him all the time because when I was a kid, real young, Willie Sutton was really known by everybody. Nowadays, I say I wrote a book about Willie Sutton, I get blank stares. He's faded from public consciousness. But when I was a kid, everybody knew the name Willie Sutton. And the guys in my uncle's bar and my grandparents and people in my hometown, they would mention him with kind of a wry smile and a shake of the head, because Willie Sutton was like a Robin Hood figure. You know, he was sticking it to the man. People put on him all these motives that I don't think he had. They ascribed a kind of nobility to him, and plus the fact that he was nonviolent, he never fired a shot, the fact that he was a master of escape, no prison was built that could hold him. I mean, all these things conspired to make the adults around me kind of admire him. And then when I was a very pivotal age, you know, when I was 11 or 12, his memoir came out, and it was kind of a big deal at the time. And he was the toast of New York for a little while. And I was very confused by this. I thought, why is this bank robber, this career criminal, so not only unrepentant, but kind of famous and kind of lionized? And why is he on Dick Cavett and Merv Griffin? And why does he wear these beautiful suits? And he's photographed in Life magazine. I mean, it really upended my moral schema. That all formed a foundation, a basis of knowledge. And then he came to mind again in 2008, so I already knew about him when I started thinking about different ways of writing about banks.
We're in conversation with author J.R. Moringer on The Kaufman Show, Dave Kaufman and Jay Farrar.
Jerry, you speak about idolizing, you know, how people idolize Sutton himself. What about, did this book change your opinion about criminals in general and the prison system?
No. I want to be clear. I want to be emphatic. I have no love for criminals. I have no love for bank robbers. This is not a glamorization of Willie. It's a look at why he became glamorized. It's a look at why he was so liked and idolized, and why when he was finally caught in 1952, crowds gathered outside his jail and chanted his name. It's an exploration of that. But it's not an apology for Willie, and it's not a gloss on him. And every time in the book that you start to like him or fall under his spell, you're brought up short. You're reminded, wait a minute, maybe I need to reconsider this. I mean, as America once did with Willie Sutton, America took a hard look at him and said, wait a minute, maybe we've made a terrible mistake with this guy. So the book hasn't changed what I think about criminals. I always knew that there are complex causes behind crime. I know that people who are victimized by the economic system sometimes feel they have no choice but to commit crimes, and I don't sanction that or validate it, but I think it deserves to be spoken about and understood. I mean, in a country where unemployment is, you know, it depends on who you ask, let's pick a number, 15%, I understand that some people are desperate and some people are driven to make terrible choices by, you know, forced by the prospect of being on the street, and I don't forgive that. I don't sanction it, but I think we have to deal with it and discuss it rationally. As far as prisons go, this book didn't change my mind of prisons. I've always had a horror of them. I have a touch of claustrophobia anyway. I mean, I don't even like flying, you know, in coach. The idea of being in a dungeon for 15, 25 years is just that's my living nightmare. And so the idea that Willie Sutton not only survived these brutal places, but escaped them every time is fascinating to me. And even though it's illogical, even though I know that it's wrong that he escaped, there is something about that will to live and the kind of incredible, cleverness that he showed, his elusiveness. It's fascinating to me. I went and sat in the cell at Eastern State Penitentiary. They don't know exactly what cell he was kept in, but they know it's one of these over here. And so you go in, the curator stands outside. It's not like Alcatraz. It's not like, you know, Disneyland. It's hardcore. The prison's now a National Historic Site. Just being in there for a few seconds made me start to just creep out. And I could imagine unraveling psychologically within a day in that cell. The idea that you could actually sit in that cell and plot your escape is, to me, it's just incredible. It says a lot about this guy's will to live. And so I guess far from changing what I think about prisons, writing this book just reinforced my horror of them.
One of the ways that I find the reader is endeared to Willie is through his times in prison and kind of struggling along and trying to deal with the time. And I feel like that's a way that the reader gets to know him very well. Now, you mentioned that there are a few times in the book where, well, you said that as soon as you like Willie, at one point you take it away. And I can think of three specific points that I don't really want to get into in great detail because I don't want to ruin it for anybody who hasn't read it. But did you find yourself buying into the mystique? And would you sort of put those moments in to remind yourself as well that
Very
maybe
much.
We shouldn't
yeah.
be falling
I mean,
in love with this character?
The thing to remember when you're reading this book is that, you know, I did a lot of research, a lot of reporting before I started to write. And what I was struck by is that the cops who chased him and caught him, the lawyers who represented him, the wardens and the guards who locked him up, the ghostwriters who wrote his memoirs and the interviewers who spent time with him, they all reported the same thing. He's impossible not to like. His literary agent is still around today and tells stories about the guy just being kind of this effervescent spirit. So his likability was a fact. And I think that that's really interesting. And I also think it's dangerous. I think it's what made him kind of dangerous. It's what made him a legend and a folk hero. So yes, I would catch myself buying into the mystique, and then that would give me an incentive to turn the plot one way or another. But this is a complex matter. I mean, because I also don't want to overcompensate in the other direction. It's a fact that in this day and age, in this culture, we have this reaction to criminals that, you know, we can't justify. Whether it's Butch Cassidy in The Sundance Kid or Gandolfini in The Sopranos, there is something about that antisocial impulse that draws us closer. We live vicariously through it. We wish we could rebel on some level. It's not real. It's not really rational. It's not really conscious. But there is a part of us that responds to the outlaw. And so I don't, you know, I don't want to be judgmental in either way. I just wanted to create a portrait of this guy that would be that would capture his spirit, and I just wanted to tell a story that I just thought was a hellaciously good story, which had been kind of faded from the history books.
Did you find the newspaper article that's essentially the essence of the story?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. Was it as bad as you allude to?
Well, I don't. I mean, I don't really think I call the guys out. As bad journalists.
No, but they come across as very,
I just
say
that the article contains, you know, some lies and some errors and you know, it didn't have a lot of information. And that's not, I don't think that's the fault necessarily of the two journalists. I mean, I have interviewed guys right when they got out of jail. Believe me, you're the last person they want to spend time with. They've just been locked up for 10, 15, 20 years. They don't want to hang with a reporter, you know. So they're not going to give you their undivided attention, and they're traumatized with this experience. It you know, it's hard to get people like that to open up. And then on top of that, Willie knew when he walked out of jail in 1969 that he was going to write a memoir, that a memoir was his only way of making any legitimate, honest money. So he wasn't going to give these guys the best stories. He wasn't going to, you know, he wasn't going to give anything away for free. He made a deal with a newspaper that if they flew him down to New York City from Attica, he would take them around and show them the scenes of his heists and other landmarks in his remarkable life. And he was good to his bargain, but the story just doesn't have much. And then also he was just incapable of saying anything straight. Telling the truth was not in his skill set. So a lot of the stuff he told them was just inaccurate, wrong, bogus. And I don't fault him for that either. That's just who he was by the time he walked out of jail at 68 years old.
Taking a tour of New York City, I think first of all, it gave the reader a great vividness of what New York used to be like. And I imagine that was the New York of your childhood, essentially.
Yeah, 69 is, you know, that's a golden age in New York. And there are many golden ages, but that's such a funky, interesting, cool time in the city. I mean, it was exploding with energy. And all kinds of countercultural forces were swirling, and so my grandmother took me into the city to see a show at Radio City Music Hall when, you know, not long after 69. So I feel like I was there. I feel like I remember the energy of it, and I had fun recreating it and reliving it. But also, essence, the story sweeps back and forth between that day when Willie gives the two journalists a tour and other New Yorks. I had fun exploring the magic of, you know, New York of the early 1900s and New York of the 30s and New York of the 50s. So there are different New Yorks that I get to live in and recreate for the reader in the book. And that's one thing that appealed to me about the story overall, but also about using this structure.
You worked with a fact checker, right?
Yes, I hired a fact checker, a guy named Eric Mercado, who has worked with me on other things before, fact checked the book I did with Andre Agassi. And he's a wonderful fact checker, works for Los Angeles Magazine. And I told him, I said, well, this is really the toughest task I've ever given you, because some of this stuff is wrong and I don't know it. Some of it is wrong and I do know it. Some of it is both wrong and right, and we'll talk about it. And he sent me the manuscript back, and it was highlighted in different colors. The green was definitely wrong. The yellow needed double check. So, but he gave into the system, and together we assembled a book. It's very rigorously fact-checked, and where a fact is wrong, I know it's wrong, or where it's not verifiable, I know it's not verifiable. So I feel like I know, you know, I can answer to each thing that someone might point to and say, this isn't correct.
Good. I've got one. I'm a massive baseball fan, and seeing that Willie paid $200 a ticket to go to the opening day of Yankee Stadium in 1923, I think it was.
Right.
I mean, that's more than it costs for a ticket at Yankee Stadium nowadays in today's dollars.
I know, but that has been fact-checked. We went back and forth about this, and what I found amazing about prices of things, like, for instance, rents at that time in New York, were as high as they are. Well, I won't say they are quite as high as they are now, but they are comparable to modern rents. The prices of things were surprisingly modern, you know, clothes and so forth. And I looked and found articles about people buying tickets outside the stadium, and they were paying more than $200. So I decided nobody will believe, you know, it was more. So we settled on that number, and it does sound exorbitant, but also I think you'll find around that section he's paying thousands for an apartment, and people have said that can't be possible back then. But it's true. Prices run in cycles along with history.
I thought that was just unbelievable.
They
talked last year when the new
stadium.
Well, didn't
Babe Ruth make $1 million at that point? Wasn't that?
Pardon?
Wasn't Babe Ruth making $1 million by then?
Yeah, but he had a better year than Herbert Hoover's. The quote.
Right. I know. But I had all the New York Times. I had a bunch of New York Times bound, and I would use them as a kind of reference for what things cost back then, and you know, whether it be a suit or a cup of coffee or a meal. And so I remember we had a discussion about this, about what it would cost to buy a scalp ticket outside the stadium. And we'd found different things online and different things in newspapers, and we settled on that number. So if we got it wrong, and if we could get in the Wayback Machine and set it to the first game at Yankee Stadium, it's not for lack of discussion.
Finally, because we've kept you on way longer than I promised your publisher we would, what's it like having a book written and coming out about somebody else? And, I mean, obviously you were very personally attached to the Agassi book because you were writing in his voice. And, well, Tender Bar is you. So how does it feel to represent a book that's nothing to do with you?
Are you talking about the Agassi book or this one now?
I'm talking about this one now. I feel like that for the Agassi book, I mean, you wrote in the first person. You essentially morphed into Andre Agassi writing that book.
I know. I felt like I had won Wimbledon and the French Open by the time we were.
You also had Brooke Shields, so that was pretty good.
Yeah, way to go.
No, but it's the same, but it's very similar to the Agassi book. It's me and it's not me. I inhabited Agassi's psyche in order to write about him, and I did it sometimes with him sitting right next to me and sometimes alone. And we were partners in the process, but writing is solitary no matter how you slice it up. So I had company sometimes, and I was alone. It felt the same with this. You know, I was inhabiting Willie's psyche, and sometimes I felt him breathing over my shoulder, and sometimes I was winging it. And it's impossible to keep your own point of view out when you're writing in the first person. And then other times I was having him say things or do things that were completely alien to me. So it's more comparable to the Agassi book than you would think. And the Agassi book was a great dry run for this because I was writing about a life that was completely alien from mine. I mean, professional tennis player from Las Vegas with his own plane and married to Brooke Shields. That's not, you know, I have no frame of reference. And so it was great practice to put myself in another man's shoes. And the difference was that when I was stuck, Agassi was always a phone call or, you know, a few blocks away, and he was fully invested in the process. And so I was never stuck for very long. When I was stuck with Willie, there was no one I could call. I could only consult old books and old newspapers and his bogus, error-filled memoirs. So I had to be more at peace with mistakes in my depiction of Willie Sutton, whereas with Agassi, he and I were determined to get it exactly right. At a certain point, I just had to let my imagination and also my logic off the leash and just say, I'm just gonna feel this, and I'm gonna follow my feelings and hope that I arrive at a kind of an intangible truth, a more abstract truth in this book. So you're onto something there. They're more alike than even I first realized they'd be at the beginning.
J.R. Moringer is the author of Sutton, which is in stores now, published by Hyperion. J.R., thank you so much for your time today.
I enjoyed it. I'll talk to you guys down the road.